We've read histories, heard stories, and seen documentaries about war, about military conflicts, about soldiers. Veterans Day honors and celebrates the service of all United States military veterans. And in the next hour, you'll hear poetry and prose from local veterans, sharing their experiences as members of the U.S. Armed Services. This is Veterans Reflections. I'm Hans Ahlstrom. Robin Romero was a staff sergeant and served as a combat medic from August 1982 to September 2006. His tours included the Gulf War, Iraqi Freedom, Bosnia with IFOR, and the Cold War tour of Germany.
Waiting for the fog to lift. An acronym, PTSD, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, on whole. Post, the past. Traumatic, physical, mental, emotional. Wounded bodies, injured minds, altered psyches. Trauma affects all. Shell shock, battle stress, combat fatigue. Former labels, same pain. I relate as a vet, not from a clinical prognosis. I can feel for vets as a vet. Suffering like so many vets. Like many vets, I have a story to tell. It began for me, a child, raised by a vet. My father, a Marine, 1st Marine Division, 7th Regiment, Guadalcanal. I saw it in him, the pain he tried to hide. I could have not understood, as a child. I played soldier, watched war movies, read books, and listened to war stories from those who were there. Yet, could still not have understood. I became a young man, then chose to become a soldier. Understanding would come, eventually. The pain became mutual, a basis for understanding, shared by father and son, as veterans. For 24 years, my story grew. Boots-on-the-ground deployments, 6 of them under my belt. Experiences, myriad chapters. Where do I begin? Which do I tell? When will I have made my point? Who would understand? Places I've been, the human condition encountered, the horrors I've seen. This I'll try. Realizations I've made. Example. The moment it dawned on me, I've seen more dead people than some small-town undertakers see in a lifetime. Images. Charred, scattered bodies along desert highways. Drowned corpses stacked along the ancient Euphrates. Piles of bleached bones. Skulls aligned as trophies. Killing fields of ethnic cleansings in villages of the Balkans. Piles of shoes, even children's. What became of the owners? Best not to go there. Situations of imminent danger. Icy chill giving way to the searing heat of adrenaline-infused blood, triggering the reflex to act and not freeze up. Soldierly training in play. Standing gun barrel to gun barrel, toe to toe, eye to eye, you dare not flinch. Mutual enemies. They from the desire to harm you, you because you're there. Their neighborhood, city, country, the intruder to them. For that there is a price to pay. A suicide bomber attacks. More images. My company commander, cradling his badly shattered right arm, refusing treatment. Until first his troops receive care. My first sergeant, hands burned, pulling his soldiers from burning flip vehicles, later refusing a Purple Heart for his efforts. The roof gunner, so young, exposed to the blast, left cheek gone, exposing a surreal grin, through slurred speech, demanding to know if his brothers made it. My dreams filled with such circumstances, and likely always will. I go on, and on I could go, not without limits, my emotions gripped in the telling of such, eased some by the passing of time, the toll it takes lessened, mercifully so. Not for all. My father's dreams, filled with enemy infiltrators in the night, the remainder of his life. Yet, I'm still here, still going. I'm learning why. Experiences aside, for such is life, I can remember being a happier person once, when laughter and smiles came easier. That memory is the light. Sorting, categorizing, labeling, good, bad, joyful, horrific, filing them away creates the fog. They are merely the sum total of one's life. I face those things, for hiding the ugly also obscures the beautiful. The old me, still there, comforted in knowing, no fog can blot the light forever. The light within that we all possess, that can only be extinguished by the self.
Robin Romero, reading his poem, Waiting for the Fog to Lift. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90, WNMU, and WNMUFM.org. Milton Bates is a local poet and writer who served during the Vietnam War.
War, thought it was a nightmare. Lord, it was so true. They told me don't go walking slow. The devil's on the loose. Better run through the jungle. Better run through the jungle. Better run through the jungle. Oh, don't look back.
Landing on the Moon. Later, he remembered how he had watched a moon mission named for the sun, Apollo, while on leave before he left for Vietnam. The eagle has landed, Neil Armstrong said, as the module nestled into moon dust. Then he descended a ladder and leapt his ungainly leap for mankind. With his shipmate Buzz, he planted the flag and scooped up soil samples. The men looked like turtles in their boxy backpacks, their helmets the size and shape of TV sets. But they could hop like kangaroos. That was in July. Now it was October, months after his own eagle had landed on a planet stranger than the moon. Stepping from the plane, he had seen a flag already planted beside the tarmac, hanging limp as seaweed in the liquid heat. Did he expect applause from mission control, crackling through static, for walking trails that sucked at his boots and soul? He did not. Yet he envied those moon men the lightness of their landing, their giddy frolic in lunar talc, their blessed reprieve from gravity. Man of God. Minutes after a soldier left the Quonset hut, the chaplain couldn't remember the guy's name or why he'd come. A skag or booze monkey on his back? A Dear John letter? Compassionate leave for a funeral? Qualms about collecting VC ears? So mundane and so unlike the ministry he'd prepared for in the seminary, where he imagined himself a Jeremiah or Ezekiel, denouncing God's people for straying from the path of righteousness, a voice crying in the wilderness. But whom to cry against when his country anointed him to be not a prophet, but an officer and a gentleman? Captain's bars outshone the tiny cross on his lapel. It was his calling now to unsimplify the simplest of the Ten Commandments, Thou shalt not kill. So he forgot the names and why they came to him, blotted out their faces. He patched up their troubled souls and sent them back to kill or be killed. It was the war, he told himself in doubtful hours, the war that made him do it. Kodak Moments. The new shirt was one too many for a closet already crammed with clothes that no longer fit or were decades out of fashion. It was time to purge. Momentum took over and carried him from the garment rack to the shelves above, littered with the jetsam of his life. He was making progress, the cast-offs piling for a trip to the thrift shop, old calendars and notebooks filling a wastebasket, when he found a box of photos excluded from the family album. He sat on his bed and lifted the lid, inhaling the faint bouquet of mildew. Then he spread them out, images captured with a cheap camera and processed cheaply at a post exchange. The colors had faded or turned into other colors. But there was no mistaking the place, the sandbag bunker, the hooch with corrugated roof, and screens tarp-draped against the monsoon rains. Familiar, too, was the soldier striking poses with an M16, his sleeves rolled up to regulation length, a bandolier across his chest, the brim of his boonie hat trained up in front like the ratty Stetson worn by Gabby Hayes in the TV westerns. Good old Gabby, always the sidekick, the clown. He wondered who had snapped those photos, whether he was still alive. Suppose they got together for a beer. Suppose he brought the pictures and fanned them on the bar like a winning hand. They would laugh and shake their heads at the kid in the boonie hat, laugh again, more thoughtfully, and shake their heads.
Milton Bates, reading his poems Landing on the Moon, Man of God, and Kodak Moments.
But I heard a rumbling calling to my name. 200 million guns are loaded, Satan cries for game. Better run through the jungle, better run through the jungle, better run through the jungle. Oh, don't beg to see.
You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90 WNMU.
I can't open up to you. Me and my friends are lonely. I don't know what to do. I always figured I'd be the one to die on. I cope smothered in smoke.
Jared Harper was a naval hospital corpsman assigned to the 1st Marine Division.
Things that you don't.
A veteran's reflection of his first deployment. I was a Fleet Marine Force corpsman assigned to 1st Tank Battalion, Bravo Company. We were attached to 1st Combat Engineer Battalion and performed route clearance missions. To sum it up, I was a combat trauma medic assigned to Marines who look for bombs all day. We arrived in Afghanistan at the beginning of October. The heat then made me thankful I missed the summer months. On the very first mission, my truck was struck by a 40-pound IED, or an improvised explosive device. My Marines and I walked away relatively okay from it, only concussions and hearing problems. When the dust settled in the truck, we called over the radio, "Green, green, green." This was to let the rest of the platoon know we were okay. Then we looked at each other and began to laugh. It was a different kind of laugh, sort of like, what the hell did we get ourselves into? It was as if we all just came to the realization that this was our life for the next 7 months and it wasn't going to be painless. What else could we do but laugh? That day set the tone for the coming months. By the end of the deployment, over half our platoon had been injured in IED explosions. Thanksgiving was one of the hardest days for us. We had 9 wounded that day. We had just left Camp Dwyer to begin another set of missions in Forward Operating Base Marja, or FOB Marja for short. On the way there, one of our lead vehicles hit a 40-pound IED. Only one Marine was injured, but nothing too serious. Again, just the typical concussion and ringing ears. I was treating him in the back of the convoy when we heard another IED go off up at the front. I grabbed my bag and rifle and rushed out the back of the truck. Just as my feet hit the dirt, another IED went off in the front. I sprinted down the convoy as fast as I could. I think we had about 10 vehicles that day, each with roughly 10 meters of dispersion between. When I got to the front, the first person I saw was Justin. He was about 20 yards out on the left side of the road. He was covered in blood and screaming for Gunny. Gunny was near the lead truck, crawling towards our EOD team leader Jason, who was face down in a blast crater. Jason had been struck by an IED blast and had lost consciousness. I didn't know it at the time, but Gunny had been knocked unconscious as well. I ran past Gunny and Jason to get to Justin when I heard Gabe yelling, "Doc! Doc!" He was just off to the right side of the road, down a steep embankment. There was blood everywhere, and he was closest to me, so I went to him first. Gabe had stepped on an IED that was buried with pieces of broken glass covering the top of it. Justin, rushing to get to Gabe, stepped on the same type of IED. The moment I saw the extent of Gabe's wounds up close, I thought, this isn't real. It's just training. An odd thought during one of the most brutally real moments of my life. I began working without hesitation. Years of training kicked in like muscle memory. My mind hadn't yet grasped the severity of it all, but my hands knew. I immediately applied tourniquets to his legs. Once I had a tourniquet on each leg, I noticed his right leg was still bleeding heavily. I added a second tourniquet, and that slowed the bleeding. His left leg was missing below the knee, and his right leg was barely attached above the knee by a small section of muscle from the back of his thigh. He also had a skull fracture from shrapnel that went up into his Kevlar. Despite his wounds, he remained calm and alert. His first words to me were, "Doc, my legs are effed, huh?" That was instantly followed up by, "Are my balls still there?" They were, and I let him know by tapping him hard in the groin, and for a moment, he laughed in pain. By the time I finished my initial treatment, Sergeant Atai made it over to us. He stayed with Gabe while I rushed to Justin. Justin was roughly 30 yards from me, across terrain where 3 IEDs had just went off. I ran as fast as I could, doing my best to step in other people's boot tracks to reduce the chances of setting off another IED. I accepted that each step I took was potentially my last, and I kept moving. When I got to him, he was missing both his legs above the knee, and his left arm was barely attached to the forearm. 2 of our other EOD team members, Lynn and Aaron, had already placed a tourniquet on each leg. I finished placing one on his left arm and instructed Lynn and Aaron to continue working on him while I ran back to check on Gabe. On the way back, I saw Gunny up and giving commands like he hadn't just been hit by 2 IEDs. Jason was conscious again, but still out of it. When I got to Gabe, his right leg was still bleeding slowly. I took out some quick clot gauze and began packing them into his leg. It was the first time I heard him truly scream out in pain. I wrapped a pressure dressing over the gauze and the stump of his leg, then treated his skull fracture. His forehead was cut so deeply from shrapnel, you could see his skull, and it was still bleeding profusely. As I finished dressing his head, Marines with the litter came over and we got him on it. I ran back over to Justin just as the helicopter was coming in. We got him on another litter and ran to the helicopter. Jason was already in as we loaded up Gabe and Justin. They flew off, and I began treating the other 6 wounded Marines. Right before I got to Gunny, he almost fell while trying to pick up something off the ground. Once I examined and questioned him, he reluctantly told me he had woken up face down in the dirt and didn't initially remember the second blast. At the time, any loss of consciousness needed to be air medevaced. We called in another helicopter for Gunny, who was livid to say the least, and understandably so. He didn't want to leave his Marines. They were his Marines, and he was responsible for them. He felt obligated to ensure their safety, to bring them home. How could he do that if he wasn't with them? I understood that perfectly. I was our platoon's corpsman after all. I had vowed to myself prior to deployment that I would bring all my Marines home, no matter the cost. My worst fear over there was failing one of them. It's the job of a Marine to fight any enemy on land or at sea. It's the job of a corpsman to fight off death. The rest of us returned to Camp Dwyer, praying that our brothers were still alive. I sat in the back of my truck, covered in blood. I replayed everything over and over in my head. Had I missed an injury on Gabe or Justin? Had I made a mistake somewhere? Were they even alive right now? I just stared at my hands. The blood was dry and seemed to fill every crease. I waited 3 days at Camp Dwyer before I called my wife and daughter. I didn't trust myself not to cry the moment I heard their voices on the phone. I was afraid of showing weakness during a time when I felt I couldn't afford it. When I did finally call, I lied and said our vehicles were broken and we were waiting on new parts to fix them. It sounded better than telling them that a third of a platoon had been wounded and we were waiting on them to recover or for the replacements to come in. I didn't want them to worry about me more than they already did. Most of the fighting in Afghanistan quieted down by the end of December. The icy cold of winter freezes the ground and makes it difficult for the Taliban to dig and place IEDs. We went weeks without a fight or discovering an IED. Those calm, cold months were just as hard as the months prior. I began to get lost in my mind, replaying my graphic experiences over and over again. Soon, it was all I would dream about. My nightmares became warped and distorted events of the war so intense, I developed a fear of sleeping. Things heated up again with the arrival of spring. The fighting intensified and the Taliban didn't waste any time in placing new IEDs. Less than a month before we were scheduled to return home, my vehicle struck another IED. This one was somewhere between 90 to 100 pounds. No one laughed that evening. I airlifted two of my Marines in my truck who had been knocked unconscious. The rest of us, I had ground medevaced. Our platoon returned home in the beginning of May. Justin was waiting for us at March Air Force Base when we landed in Southern California. I think we were happier to see him than we were being home, and trust me, we were happy to be home. Gabe was still receiving treatment in Bethesda, so we didn't get to go see him then. I spent that 4th of July on the beach at Camp Pendleton with my family. The base hosts a huge celebration with fireworks and live performances pretty much every year. The base hosts a huge celebration with fireworks and live performances pretty much every year. I was walking through the crowds when I heard someone yelling, "Doc! Doc!" Instantly, I knew. I turned and spotted Gabe in the crowd. He was standing on his new prosthetic legs. I ran to him, hugged him, and began to cry. I can't describe how that moment felt for me, so I won't even try. Like many of the Marines I deployed with, I didn't realize the extent of my injuries upon returning home. We all bore invisible scars, and some of us physical ones. I had my first spinal surgery within a year of being home. To this day, I continue to receive treatment for my neck and back injuries nearly a decade later. The physical injuries we sustained were minor compared to the mental and emotional damage done by war. To experience war is to experience the worst a person can do to another person. That's something that stays with and changes you, but it's not something you have to endure alone. To any brother or sister out there still fighting that internal war that never seems to end, you aren't alone. You didn't have to fight alone overseas then, and you don't have to fight alone at home now.
Jared Harper, reading A Veteran's Reflection of His First Deployment. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90 WNMU. Dr. Bill Finlan was a Korean combat veteran
He passed away in July of 2019. His reflection, a selected series of events related to my military experience, is read by Robin Romero.
To jump into the river and drown.
Getting ready for the military. I have had numerous stints in my life outside the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. The first one I worked in the woods with my father just after I turned 16. And that spring, I went, duffel bag in hand, by myself to work as a farmhand near O'Connell Falls, Wisconsin, with the intent to finish high school. The farmer answered my knock on the door. I told him I needed a job and that I wanted to finish high school. He smiled and invited me in for lunch. I stayed there almost 3 years. I finished high school and volunteered for the U.S. Army draft, then off to the induction center in Milwaukee on December 9th, then a long bus ride to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri for basic training. Mine was not the usual basic training. The holidays came almost immediately, and half of us got to go back home for a few days. Of course, I went straight to my longtime girlfriend Marlene's home in Lena and had a nice dinner with her family. She was upset that I volunteered for the draft, and after lunch a young man came to the house and she left with him. Wow, what a shock. I thought we were bound together for life. That afternoon I went back to the farm and got my stuff and hitched back to Fort Leonard Wood 3 days before my leave was finished, still very distraught. Back at the base, I looked frantically for things to do with my remaining 2 days of leave. A fellow GI and I headed for the base gym on Sunday afternoon to watch the tryouts for the base Golden Glove boxing team. Of course, I was in a fighting mood from my said experience back home. When the six featherweights completed their tryouts in the ring, I happened to be standing next to the boxing coach. Like a smart aleck, I told the coach that I thought I could beat any two of those featherweights at the same time. Of course, he anxiously invited me to join the squad, but I threw a monkey wrench into his idea when I told him that I just started basic training. What company are you in? He asked. I told him I had just started basic training in C Company. No problem, he laughed. Your company commander is my buddy. I will talk to him and make arrangements for you to try out next Sunday. His idea of arrangements were far better than I expected. He got my commander to agree to give me a Jeep and the afternoons off to train. Every time I was in the ring for a match, my commander marched the entire training group down to support me, a member of their outfit. Unbelievable. Long story short, I won the base championship in the featherweight division and soon found myself on a bus with the team, heading for Springfield, Missouri. I easily won my first and second fights. Then I found myself facing the Navy champion, who had been doing this for 7 years, and I had been doing this for several months. Now I am in the ring with this wiry Navy guy. The bell rings. I am thinking I had to surprise him and get an advantage. He steps towards me a little, and I unleash the best right I have ever thrown, and it lands square on his forehead. Down he goes. He had never been knocked down before. He gets up at the count of eight, and I was going to do it again. That's all I remembered until they were taking my gloves off in the locker room. A large picture of me landing on my face appeared on the sports page of the Kansas City Star. A month later, I went secretly to a clinic because I was still having some neck pain. The doctor told me I should never box again because the shot I took had badly wrenched my neck vertebrae. I didn't say anything to my unit leaders until the 1st of November when I announced that I would not be boxing on the team anymore. 16 days later, I was on orders for the 16th Infantry Regiment, 24th Division in Korea. So much for loyalty. Fort Leonard Wood, basic training. A person finishes high school and they generally make the great assumption that they are completely ready for adult life. But those who go through basic military training get a fast and certain education about the fact that you are not ready for life. If one is standing outside the barracks in a basic training unit on the first morning of a group's training, one can see the blank stares and the lost souls stepping out into the unknown of military. They fumble at every stage of marching. They fumble at listening to and going through an order from the first sergeant. They are dumbfounded when a leader at one of the training sessions asks if anyone knows anything about a car, and they raise their hands, and the leader says, "Great, I need some mechanically oriented. Here are 500 pencils. Sharpen them." The lesson there is that a trainee should always be careful about volunteering. Some take a week to learn the few basic movements of marching. Some will never learn to make a bed that a quarter can bounce off of. Some will always be nervous about firing an M1 or a rocket launcher. Then there is the night in the middle of the winter, and it is 3 a.m. The first sergeant turns on the lights in the barracks, yelling, "Everybody outside, just as you are!" You had been cleaning your rifle and polishing your shoes until 12:30 in the morning. You start to put on your shoes, and the man yells, "Just as you are," I said. Everyone goes outside and stands tall in formation in the freezing cold, barefoot. Sarge walks slowly back and forth in front of the unit and says, "You probably wonder why I told you to come out here just as you are. Well, if you are in a war and you are attacked, you are not going to have time to put on your pants and shirt and coat and socks and shoes and comb your hair." He went further to tell us that we would be getting up at 4:30 in the morning to go on a 7-mile force march, which basically means you will run the entire 7 miles to the rifle range. And then, after a few days training at the rifle range, you will have another force march back to the barracks. He yelled, "Dismissed!" In the morning, with an M1 rifle and about 80 pounds on our backs, we headed for the rifle range. This was their way of seeing if we were in good enough shape. At mile 4, recruits began lagging, getting screamed at, and even collapsing. The first sergeant simply ignored them all and kept us running. We had no idea if they would be helped or not. At the rifle range, we learned the important words, breathe, aim, slack, squeeze. This had to do with when you were about to fire your rifle. People were screamed at for careless actions with the rifles. Soon all of us were picking off targets, long and short. The rifles kicked, but we sucked it up. Strange story. After I finished the boxing season in April, they didn't know what to do with me until November, when the next boxing started. So they sent me to basic engineer training for 8 weeks, including heavy equipment training. Then they assigned me to a motor pool job, where we paved the entire 7 miles to the rifle range with piles of blacktop dumped into the middle of the road, and we spread it with shovels. Well, a brand new blacktopping machine sat in the motor pool so it would not get dirty. And later, two of my brothers were bused to the rifle range during their basic training on the same road. No forced march for them. When we finished the blacktopping, we were assigned to build a 75-foot-high building for the motor pool. Our first job was putting up the steel. I wasn't afraid of heights, so I worked on top of the skeletal structure. One very hot Missouri day, when the steel was cooking my feet and hands, I suddenly got dizzy and fell. I reached out with one of my strong arms and grabbed a 12-foot-wide hot beam and clung to it. I felt a rupture pop in my groin. Luckily, I had just finished a boxing season, so I had the strength. Also luckily, a fireman was sitting on our side of the firehouse, and he saw me. They got the fire truck and ladders and rescued me before I fell to the pavement 75 feet below. I did get a long burn under my arm from the hot steel. In the hospital, a big, tough-looking nurse prepped me for the hernia repair by grabbing my appendage and holding it straight out while she shaved me with a straight razor. That was quite an experience for a shy 19-year-old. I grew up a little in about 30 seconds. The doctor kept me 3 days and then told me to spend some time in the barracks for the next month off. Within hours, I had my suitcase and was hitchhiking 850 miles to home, bent over, of course, and I pitched a baseball game the second week I was home. I wrote a poem while I was at Fort Leonard Wood. Army Life. A whole new life I can't explain, a rugged life of mental pain. From mixed-up kid to simple man, for each the Army has a plan. The job you get you'd never choose, the girl you have you'll always lose. You grasp the habits of this life, and curse the man who has a wife. You learn to scrub, to sew, to clean, to call the bathroom a latrine. You shine your boots and all your brass, you just can't wait to get a pass. When each old day drags to an end, and payday's just around the bend, you're broke as any guy could be, dreaming of a spending spree. You'll buy a drink for you and Al, and also Fred, because he's your pal. You see a girl and want a date. Joe's been there first. Boy, you're too late. You wander with no place to go, no friends to meet, no girls to know, no mom, no dad, no sister Sue, no one to tell your troubles to. So back you go to barracks land, and tell the guys the time was grand, and dream of all the dreams you plan when you're done serving, Uncle Sam. One fun thing I did was to buy a Studebaker. It was a presidential four-door car, and every weekend I head off, I would take five soldiers for $20 apiece to where they wanted to go. That's how I made my car payments. One weekend, we went to St. Louis to see a free St. Louis Cardinals baseball game. Military got in free. We sat in center field, and Stan Musial broke the home run record by hitting five home runs in the doubleheader. It is very interesting how the military basic training can change a person so much in attitude and character and have them understand the importance of following orders at any cost. Going to Korea. I found my way to Seattle and spent several days with my beloved Uncle Stanley before we debarked from Fort Lewis. 3,400 troops on the ship headed through Puget Sound and across the Pacific to South Korea. And of course, none of us knew anything about anything. Like blind men spending time on a big metal ship, crossing the biggest ocean on Earth, going to Korea. The first surprise was one of the biggest storms in 50 years was raging across the entire North Pacific, and it was even very challenging to leave Puget Sound and get on the ocean. Within half a day, most of the GIs were seasick. Vomit was everywhere. Bunks were stacked six high in the troop compartments, and you did not want to be on the bottom bunk. The stench was terrible. Luckily, I had a top bunk. I got assigned to the ship's kitchen to help with making meals and washing dishes. Another major problem emerged. The food order for the entire ship usually included a variety of frozen vegetables, but this order only included asparagus. The odor of asparagus combined with the stench of all the sick soldiers gave me a repulsive attitude toward asparagus that I still have with me 59 years later. I haven't eaten asparagus since. All 3,400 of us were ordered to spend at least 2 hours each day on the deck for fresh air. By the time we arrived south of the Aleutian Islands, two-thirds of the way to Korea, the waves were peaking at near 75 feet high. The propellers of the ship began leaving the water over each crest and spinning so much out of control that it made the entire ship shudder. The ship was shut down and sea anchors were set to stabilize it for 3 days. One day, while we were all miserable on deck, with salty seawater spray hitting us with each large wave, and about half of us beginning to recover from the seasickness, we looked out on the sea and saw this Japanese fishing boat calmly riding each wave and going on its merry way. We marveled that the fishermen saw nothing wrong with their situation. After 23 days of riding out the Great Pacific weather, we rounded South Korea near Busan and headed up the western coast toward Incheon, the primary debarkation area for ground military. Incheon is an area with enormous sea tides. Our ship had to park 5 miles away from the shore because everything inward was far too shallow. When the tide was in, there was enough water in the mud flats for us to debark from the ship by climbing down the riggings and get into the small LSTs, which took us to the shore and the very large reception area. It was pouring rain, 3,400 troops standing tall in the pouring rain. One lieutenant on a podium giving us simple instructions. Suddenly, five jet fighters swooped down on us like they were going to attack. The lieutenant shouted, "Hit the deck!" Every one of us tried to get underground in an instant. Of course, the lieutenant knew the jets were American, and he was just having fun with the raw troops. He laughed his butt off and called us all to attention. The pilots of the jets must have been having fun, too. Still raining, I saw a non-commissioned officer coming down our row, asking for a soldier who could type, because they needed a supply assistant in headquarters company. I looked and saw no volunteers and thought, at least that place would be inside and dry. I raised my hand and was taken to a nearby supply tent. There I met my first career soldier, Sergeant Wild, who seemed like he had been in every American war. I immediately told him I had lied and I had zero typing experience. His face flushed. I reminded him that no one else could type either. "Well, I can tell you you have balls, so I will give you 2 weeks to learn how to type. You don't have to do anything else but teach yourself to type." I spent the entire 2 weeks, about 14 hours a day, typing. Now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of their country. Sarge let me keep the job, and I have been very good at typing, even on this computer, for the rest of my life, producing university papers, journalistic stories, and many published books. Short timer in Korea. I had already served a year of Army duty in the States when I arrived in Korea, so some of the men who had gotten there before me would be leaving after me because of the tour of duty was 18 months. Not long after I began working in supply for Sergeant Wild, I became the supply boss myself because he retired. One of the first things I did was cooperate with regiment commander in ordering lumber for the base of each 9-man tent in our unit. The commander was a character. He had a calendar made for each tent, featuring pictures of him. When the lumber came, he had it stacked in an open area and requested 25 men to build the officers a handball court with the lumber that was supposed to be used to improve our tents. This infuriated me so I logged all of the proceedings with my camera and noted everything. When they finished, I sent a complete account and pictures of the handball court to the Pentagon. 3 weeks later, a team of Army investigators came. They talked to the commander and then hauled him off in handcuffs. He lost all of his military ranking and benefits and was thrown out of the Army. During the summer, we moved to a barren valley with high mountains on either side of a small stream north of Seoul. The land was rugged and needed leveling on either side of a stream for the tents and equipment. We had a D-10 bulldozer, but no one in the motor pool could operate it but me. I had been to the heavy equipment school in Fort Leonard Wood, so I began the week-long project of leveling the ground on each side of the stream. On the second day, I was moving some material on high ground, and suddenly my dozer began slowly sinking. I stopped the machine to see if I should bail out. It slowly sank as I heard timbers cracking below. When the sinking dozer finally stopped sinking, I could barely see above the ground. My machine and I were completely underground, and I had discovered an underground hospital that had been left behind by the North Koreans. It took me an extra 4 days to get out of there with the machine and fill the hole for our project. The place was narrow and about 300 feet long and filled with hospital materials. A few weeks later, I reported to the company commander that we were short 50 sheets in supply. Imagine having sheets on a small collapsible bed. Some of the men would tear their sheets in half so they could turn in half a sheet each week for clean whole ones and trade the other half sheet to one of the area women for favors. I told the company commander that I had learned that the Marines to the east by the DMZ had some extras, and I thought I could trade them for 2 cases of whiskey. Because the Marines were not allowed alcohol in the field, but our officers had alcohol. The next day, I left for the Marine base with the whiskey, 2 guards, shotguns, and my supply driver and a jeep. I intended to do a little pheasant hunting on the way. At the Marine base, the commander welcomed the whiskey and found 50 sheets for me. I returned to the base in 2 days with 7 pheasants and 50 sheets. Mission accomplished. My commander was very happy. One Sunday morning, I woke up hearing, "Hut, hut, 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 hut." I knew none of our units would be out doing a force march at 6 a.m. on a Sunday. I got up and looked outside the supply tent and couldn't see anything like marching soldiers. I heard it again, "Hut, hut, 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 hut." I looked high up on the ridge of the South Mountain, and there was a unit of Turkish troops jogging along in unison. They looked so small up there on the mountain. Soon they were out of sight and sound. I remembered someone told me that when the Turks first came to the Korean War, the American leader told the Turk leader that they would bombard their assigned area first, before they went in to clean up. The Turkish leader told the American leader, "If you do that, we will be going home. We came here to fight, not clean up leftovers. We prefer the personal combat." They were a tough bunch. Anyway, that Sunday evening about dusk, I heard them again jogging along on the ridge of the North Mountain. I had wondered if they'd run all day. Don't misunderstand, I pulled plenty of soldier duty too. Imagine we are on the bottom of this deep valley between 2 mountain ridges. North Korean infiltrators and local thieves always tried to get the best of us. The thieves were focused on my supply because they wanted boots, clothes, long johns, weapons, etc. So my weapons man, my assistant supply man, and I always slept on cots in the supply tent with carbines and 45s hanging near us. One terribly rainy afternoon, I was selected to pull a 2-hour guard duty assignment on the side of a mountain above the camp, like I did every week or so. I sucked it up and pulled my duty, but I could not wait to get back in my supply tent and out of the cold and rain. When my replacement came, I politely said hi and asked him where he was from. He said he was from Michigan. I asked him where in Michigan. He said Gladstone. I could not believe that this soldier standing in the pouring rain on the side of a Korean mountain, was from 5 miles away from my parents' home. I stayed the entire 2 hours of his duty, both of us talking about many things, happily and ignoring the drenching rain. On weekends, I often traded with the captain what he wanted, like boots or hats or long johns or socks from the supply, for flying lessons in the small helicopter and the single-engined Beaver plane. Those lessons paid off big when I did lots of flying during college years in my summer supply job for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in western Alaska, overseeing the salmon fishing in Bristol Bay. I had a supply assistant who was happy-go-lucky and loved to go around the base doing things for the company commander and me. He had left behind a wife. One day, he got a Dear John letter from his wife saying that she wanted a divorce because she was in love with his brother. Crazy is not a good enough word to describe this soldier's reaction. I felt sorry for him, and all he could say was that he wanted to go home and kill his brother and straighten things out with his wife. I contacted the Red Cross people in Seoul, and they talked our company commander into letting him have emergency leave because he was almost done with his tour of duty. In Korea at that time, all military had to pass testing for any sexual diseases. He failed the test. Now he was even more crazy. I talked to the clinic doctor, and he agreed to give the soldier a shot to stop any signs of his problem. He got on a flight home and wrote to us later that he had beat up his brother and put his marriage back in order, and they were living happily. After several weeks more, I got permission to go to Osaka, Japan on a religious retreat. This meant that we could fly in a C-130 with bucket seats from Seoul to Tokyo across the huge body of water. About 70 men from different units throughout Korea were loaded on the plane and sat on the bucket seats without seatbelts. Halfway to Japan, we encountered terrible vertical air draft, and the plane dropped about 1,000 feet in an instant. Men were all over the ceiling during the drop. When the fall suddenly stopped, we all crashed to the seats and the floor, sometimes men on men. More than 35 had broken bodies. I was fortunate to be unscathed. The retreat in Osaka was wonderful, with peaceful sessions and a great sand beach in a community that was mostly old traditional Japanese. Woody was my weapons man in supply. We got along great. One day he said to me, "Boss, you are a smart cookie. Why don't you think about going to college when you get home? G.I. Bill would take care of most of your costs." I had never thought about college before that day. Suddenly it was something worth looking into. I wrote a letter to my former high school agriculture teacher, Peter, at O'Connell Falls, Wisconsin, and he wrote back saying, "Bill, I went to Wisconsin State University at River Falls near St. Paul, and I think it would be a good fit for you." That was it. I was going to River Falls when I got out. Of all the different places I have studied, River Falls was by far the best. Great teachers. One of the enjoyable and productive things I did in Korea for several months was go with my chaplain's assistant friend on Saturday afternoon to the Mary Knoll Orphanage near Busan. We helped the sisters as much as we could and slept overnight on the floor of their main room with about 150 kids. These kids were the product of local women having kids with area soldiers. When the women got pregnant, their families often told them they had to leave the family if they kept the child. So many Korean women gave their children to the orphanage. Doing this for us was a great way of staying in reality in an unreal situation. Going back home to America. One thing I learned on the way to Korea was that I never wanted to spend 23 days living in and on a troop ship that was heaving all over the sea with me at its mercy. So being a supply boss, I selected the best boots and clothes for a uniform and had my Korean supply helper polish and iron them for me for my time on the ship going back home. Hopefully there would be no storm and this time would be more than cut in half. I assembled this new outfit for a purpose. Just after the 1st of November, I was assigned to the debarkation unit in Incheon to wait for our ship, the Mitchell, to arrive and take us back to the USA. About 3,000 of us waited around playing cards, threw footballs, and generally did what you do in the Army, hurry up and wait. Soon the ship arrived. Anxious troops, including me and a newfound friend, became even more restless. When boarding began, I saw that we again had to be transported by LST to the ship waiting 5 miles away. My friend and I watched all day as men with their duffel bags passed through the 10-foot-high, chain-linked fence and marched in a single file along the dock and left the base in those boats. We got closer and closer to the gate. Very exciting. I was thinking about my plan to make this good trip across the ocean. OMG, we were almost at the gate. The troops left in groups large enough to fill the boat, and now my friend and I were right at the gate. We were next. And the military police guarding the gate walked over, shut the gate and locked it, announcing that the ship was full, and we would have to wait for the next ship. It was so shocking to us, it was like being locked in prison. There we were, still in the debarkation center. I had written a letter to my parents, telling them I was leaving on the Mitchell, and I would be home in about 3 weeks. Talk about a group of depressed soldiers. A week later, another ship came. We were all safe on board and on the way home. I raced to the assigned compartment in the troop ship, changed my outfit to the perfect uniform and boots, and immediately reported to the ship's executive officer. He was rather young, but pleasant and smart. "Sir," I said, "I am requesting that you accept me as your assistant for troop services during the trip." He looked at me for a minute and said, "You look like a movie soldier. Can you type and talk to people?" "Yes, sir, I can do everything you need. I talked to the assistant on the ship on the way over here." "You're my man. I will prepare you a pass to every line, including the chow line, movie lines, game lines, and whatever you want to do on the ship. And you can shower when you need to in my private shower in my suite. When should I report, sir?" 8 a.m. Use your pass to get breakfast early. Don't be late. One thing I am is punctual, sir. You'd better be. Get out of here." "Thank you very much, sir." Needless to say, I had a much better trip back to America, but we had to reroute to San Francisco instead of Seattle because of a small storm to the north. I finally got home to Escanaba on November 28th. When I walked in the door of the old dilapidated place we called home in the chemical plant location near Escanaba, my mother immediately began screaming hysterically. I knew right away that something was wrong because that was not a behavior of my mother of 12 kids. "Patty," my dad looked stunned. "You are supposed to be dead, and we have been expecting soldiers to bring your body any day." "What the hell are you talking about? I'm here, alive. You told us in your letter that you were leaving on the Mitchell, right?" "But we never got on," Dad continued. "Bill, all of the soldiers from the Mitchell heading for Fort Sheridan by Chicago were on a plane and they crashed into a mountain. No survivors. I can't believe you are here." Mother kept screaming hysterically while she hugged me. I was her oldest child and pet because she was only 16 when I was born. We practically grew up together. We all sat down to dinner. It was the best meal of my entire life. Perch, mashed potatoes, canned string beans, and Mom's apple pie. After dinner, Dad had a beer and asked me if I wanted one, because he knew I never drank alone. I said no, and he left it at that. We played a few games of cribbage. I worked in a fence-making company at the nearby Cedar outfit until March, when I left for River Falls to start college on my GI Bill money. I found work all 4 years of undergraduate and received degrees in English, journalism, biology, and education. During my last semester, I received a grant from Michigan State University to teach undergraduate biology and work on my master's degree. But a week before leaving for MSU, the superintendent of Escanaba Schools asked me to teach 9th grade English. My wife and I agreed to do that, and she got a kindergarten teaching job. I did a 3-year stint in Gwinn after 5 years at Escanaba while getting my master's in secondary administration, and we left to complete my career as a legislative journalist in the state capitol and the national capitol through Macomb Intermediate School District near Detroit, where I got my doctorate in education, leadership, and administration. Not bad, a high school dropout with his doctorate. I retired back home and built a 3,200-square-foot home by myself on our old home property where I live. I hesitate to think what my life would have been like without the Army and the GI Bill.
Robin Romero, reading A Selected Series of Events Related to My Military Experience by Dr. Bill Finlan, also adding a short biography of Finlan at the end.
Good night.
You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90 WNMU. Our thanks to Milton Bates, Robin Romero, the late Dr. Bill Finlan, and Jared Harper for sharing their work on Veterans Reflections. Veterans Reflections is a production of Public Radio 90 WNMU. I'm Hans Ahlstrom.